Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM and FM HD1. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. In this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1054, our topic will be the turmoil in apartheid Israel, the new Israeli fascist government, the proposed judicial changes, reactions to what is happening amongst the Jewish communities in the US and other areas, media coverage of how Israeli forces are handling Israeli demonstrators versus Palestinian demonstrators, and the impact the new government has on the Palestinians. I will discuss all of that and much more with Richard Silverstein, who is joining us via phone from Seattle, Washington. Richard Silverstein is a freelance journalist. He writes the Tikkun Olam blog, devoted to exposing the excesses of the Israeli national security state. His work has appeared in Haaretz, The Middle East Eye, The Nation, The New Arab, The Guardian, The Los Angeles Times, The Forward, and The Seattle Times. He contributed to the essay collection devoted to the 2006 Lebanon War, A Time to Speak Out, and has another essay in the collection, Israel and Palestine, Alternate Perspectives on Statehood. Richard, welcome to Arab Voices.
Thank you, Saeed. It's great to be with you, and I want to wish your listeners a Ramadan Mubarak.
Thank you. It's good to have you again on the show. Richard, the strikes and protests by the hundreds of thousands of Israeli demonstrators over the past few days have been unprecedented and unseen before in apartheid Israel, against the proposed judicial reforms in Israel by the new extremist far-right fascist Israeli government. Before we discuss the details of why that is happening and the impact, could you please explain to our listeners how the Israeli government is formed and made up of, so our listeners can understand and be better informed when we discuss the details of what is happening now with the government? Maybe things like the roles of the prime minister, the Knesset or the cabinet, and the judicial system. Sure. It's political system, if you will.
Sure. Israel is, unlike the United States, it is basically a two branches of government. There's the Knesset, which is legislative, and there's the Supreme Court, which is the judiciary. The prime minister is not an executive in the same sense that our president is. He's the leader of the governing coalition. And in Israel's case right now, Bibi Netanyahu is the prime minister. And as you mentioned, the governing coalition is a cobbled-together group of right-wing, the most moderate members of this coalition are right-wing, and they range all the way to the far-right, sort of almost fascist. There are even some ministers in this government who are actually former terrorists, convicted of terrorism. So that's the sort of spectrum of the current government. The judiciary in Israel, the Supreme Court, can, like the United States Supreme Court, can review laws and can disqualify them based on whether they conform to what's called the basic laws. Israel does not have a constitution. They never could get around to agreeing on what should be in it from 1948, so they never have had that, but they do have a set of basic laws that sort of lay out the general parameters of the legal parameters of the state. So the Supreme Court can review laws and can disqualify them. The Attorney General, and these are all bodies that are under debate in these so-called reforms, both the power of the Attorney General and the power of the Supreme Court. The Attorney General also can review laws and can also tell the government that they're not qualified, and can get them thrown out in that sense. The Knesset is composed of 120 members. The majority, there are coalitions composed of different sets of parties, and they have to get to 61 votes in order to form a government. There's also a president of Israel who plays a ceremonial role, but in this case, the president of Israel is trying to play a very important mediator role in this crisis that the country is facing. He's trying to get the right-wing coalition government to sit down and talk to the opposition to see if they can come up with compromises. And that's really at the heart of what's been happening over the last 4 or 5 days in Israel, because the defense minister, whose name is Yoav Gallant, a former general in the IDF, he went on national television and told the prime minister, this is really unprecedented, he told the prime minister to back down and to take a breath and take a pause and sit down and negotiate with the other side. That is something that Netanyahu has been unwilling to do up until now. And as soon as his defense minister did that, he fired him. When he fired Gallant, the country, which was already in an uproar and had been demonstrating for 11 straight weeks, became even more furious. And people came out in the hundreds of thousands. People, media is estimating 600,000 Israelis came out. And the main highway through Tel Aviv, normally the police try desperately to keep anyone, any protesters from blocking the highway. And they had, I would guess, 100,000 people on the highway. And it was totally impossible for the police to do anything. And there are pictures of this 100,000 people on this major highway. You can imagine sort of like in whatever your main highway is in your particular city, what would happen if 100,000 people all of a sudden decided they were going to, you know, march through it. So this is unprecedented, and it presented Netanyahu with a situation where he had no choice, really. He also, and we can talk more about this later, he also had Joe Biden and the U.S. ambassador pressuring him constantly, insistently for days, demanding essentially that he back down and that he take a pause in this process. And I should explain that what this governing coalition has been doing has been passing bills, maybe, you know, 20, 30, 40 bills are in this pipeline that would turn Israel from what I would call a quasi-democracy into an outright fascist state.
And we want to talk about this a whole lot more. Because that's obviously what's leading to these protests and strikes throughout apartheid Israel. That's the name that I'd like to call it, what it is, apartheid Israel. But if you could go back a little bit, just a few months back, because there were even a lot of oppositions and a lot of outrage at even forming this new government, because this government has been in office since the end of 2022, right? That's when they were elected. And it's not the first time that Netanyahu is in prime minister of Israel. He has been prime minister before. So tell us more why the outrage about the new government, let alone the changes and the judicial system change they want to implement. Members of this new government and the coalition that Netanyahu formed that made him win this recent election.
Well, Netanyahu, as you mentioned correctly, Israel has been governed for most of the last 55 years by right-wing coalition governments, mostly led by the Likud, which is Netanyahu's party, which goes back historically to Zev Jabotinsky, the founder of the sort of revisionist movement, which is the right-wing Israeli political movement. So for 55 years, the right-wing has governed Israel. And this government is unlike any previous right-wing government. And they were all pretty right-wing. I mean, there were governments that were where the prime minister was a former terrorist who had murdered British soldiers before 1948, et cetera. Shamir, Begin, you know, people like that. But this government has two ministers, just as an example, who have been convicted of terrorist offenses. One minister who has been convicted twice of financial crimes and corruption, and the laws in Israel prohibit him from being a minister, but he was proposed anyway as a minister. The only reason that Netanyahu had to back down was the Attorney General said, no, you can't appoint him. But one of the laws that they're proposing would allow this minister to serve. And there are a number of laws that are specifically designed to counter the criminal charges that Netanyahu faces for corruption. There are four counts, and he's in the middle of a trial. And if he is convicted, he, under Israeli law, would be immediately disqualified as prime minister. So one of the other laws they're proposing is that the attorney general cannot disqualify a prime minister based on a criminal conviction. So there seems to be a new law for any crime or any bit of corruption that any minister in this government has ever done before or is currently on trial for. And so that's one of the reasons why this government is so incredibly extreme. That the other thing about this government is that the members of it, the right-wing members of it, are deeply misogynistic, deeply homophobic, deeply Islamophobic. Any possible type of racism you can think of, there are members of this government, there are ministers in this government who are guilty of it. So it's like a rogue's gallery of corrupt, genocidal ministers. And it's really astonishing for Israel. I've been following politics in that country for 30 or 40 or even more years, and I've never seen anything quite like this before.
Yeah, and this fascist government, it's, I mean, one of the ministers in it now, the finance minister, Smotrich, he said the other day, there is no such thing as Palestinians. And before, you know, about a couple of weeks ago or so, he said, wipe out the Palestinian town of Hawara. Wipe it out, calling for genocide, as if Israel is not doing genocide already against the Palestinian. But, you know, straightforward to the world, wipe out Hawara. He's a minister in that Israeli government. It is really astonishing and outrageous that we, the United States government, support such governments, finance what they do, send them money, and stand by them no matter what. And yes, we want to talk a whole lot more about the United States and its reaction to what's happening there a little bit later in this program. So with this fascist government in place, the most far-right-wing government in Israel's history, as you mentioned, hundreds of thousands of demonstrators in the streets, they don't want this government, and they don't really specifically want the changes that the government is proposing to do with the judicial reform. And I know you talked about there are so many other bills that they are passing and trying to pass. Let's dive a little bit more into that judicial reform. Some people say, well, the main thing is because Netanyahu wants to protect himself.
He's charged for four counts of corruption, and
yes,
he's right now on trial for them, yeah.
So he wants to protect himself. So with the new reforms, if that takes place, the judicial reform, then he doesn't have to let go his office and he can continue to be in power. Tell us more about the proposed judicial reform by this fascist government.
Well, the Supreme Court has been the bête noire of the Israeli right wing for decades. At one time, long ago, the Supreme Court was a liberal Supreme Court, and it upheld human rights, and it outlawed torture, and but it hasn't been that sort of Supreme Court for a very long time. It's actually a right-wing Supreme Court, but that's not enough for this far-right government. They want to basically emasculate the Supreme Court so that it can never stand in the way of any law that the Knesset passes. So the way they're going to do that is they're going to take away the power of the court to review legislation. So if the court gets a law to review and says that it disqualifies the law, the Knesset can overrule the Supreme Court. This is the proposed law. It can overrule the Supreme Court with 61 votes. Anything the Supreme Court says, it can ignore. So the other thing that they want to do is right now justices are appointed to the Supreme Court by an independent committee that's composed of a diverse set of people in the legal system in Israel. They want to do away with this committee, and they want to put on this new version of the committee only Likud stalwarts, only far-right Knesset, members of Knesset or ministers. So they will in turn appoint the kinds of justices that they want on the court. So they'll get even more right-wing justices than already exist. The other thing that they want to do is they want to take away from the Attorney General not only the right to disqualify a prime minister, they want to take away from the Attorney General the right to review legislation, which is what I mentioned. They also, every ministry in Israel has a chief legal officer to determine whether regulations that the ministry proposes are legal or not. They want to take away the right of civil service to appoint those lawyers and give those decisions to the minister himself. So if you have a far-right minister like Smotrich or Ben-Gvir, he's going to appoint somebody as his chief legal advisor who's as far-right as he is. So those are just some of the proposals that deal with the judicial aspect of things. One other thing that I just thought about today that nobody has been mentioning. Netanyahu, in those corruption charges, is accused of accepting hundreds of thousands of dollars in gifts, including white champagne, or pink champagne, sorry, that Sarah Netanyahu is very fond of pink champagne. So she had the Hollywood producer Arnon Milchan go out and buy her crates of white champagne. And he happens to like Cuban cigars, so Milchan's secretary would go out and spend thousands of dollars buying him his favorite cigar. But these gifts amount to hundreds of thousands of dollars, and under Israeli law, they're illegal. So that's one of the charges against him. But guess what? One of the new bills will say that a prime minister can accept any amount of money and any type of gift from anyone at any time. So that's what I meant when I said there's a new bill for every possible, you know, outcome that you could think of.
So basically, the overhauling the Israeli judicial system gives lawmakers an unchecked powers to do whatever they want to do.
Exactly.
Now,
exactly. As I mentioned, that there's two branches of government. Under this proposed new system, there will be one branch of government.
Yeah. There are strikes also in Israel, and I don't know offhand if they are still happening or they stopped after after Netanyahu announced that he is pausing, not stopping, not canceling, but pausing the process of reforming the judicial reform. He's pausing that for a couple of months until they talk internally. But there were strikes that affected universities and other areas in Israel. I think the Israeli General Consul in New York resigned after Netanyahu fired the Israeli Defense Minister. So there was a ripple effect that was happening throughout Israel and outside.
So the Israeli workers' union is called the Histadrut. It's a national union. The head of the Histadrut announced at one of the big rallies, like Friday or Saturday, he said, "We're calling a national general strike for Monday." Never happened ever in the history of the country that there was a general strike of the entire nation. So there was a one-day strike, and as soon as Bibi announced he was pausing the legislation, the head of the Histadrut said, the strike is over. That doesn't mean that they're not willing to strike again, but for now, the strike is over. But one other thing that we should mention is that, yes, universities were on strike and the workers were on strike, but the military itself, some of the senior officers in the army said that we will no longer do reserve duty. We won't come to train if there were pilots in the Israeli Air Force, which is quite an important part of the Israeli military these days. They said, we won't serve if this judicial coup happens. And there even were active duty officers who said, we won't serve. So that's one of the reasons why Gallant resigned. That's one of the reasons why he defied Netanyahu, went on TV and said, stop the coup. Because he knew he was hearing from his officers telling him there was a mutiny afoot if the defense minister didn't take some action. So when the army, which is a very important institution in the country, stands up against the prime minister and defies him, that is something unprecedented in the country.
And I think it was Israel's army chief of staff who said that a storm is brewing at home as thousands of military reservists threatened not to serve in the military if the reform passes.
That's right. Haaretz wrote something astonishing. They said, the journalist who is very close to military sources said, there were senior officers who were ready to resign their commissions and leave the army if this were to happen, which is, as I said, unheard of.
Now, with the firing of the minister Gallant, some called that a security crisis for Israel. Is it reaching that level?
Well, it could. I think that you and I and many people are very critical of the army and the military, obviously, and the intelligence services. But in terms of the role that it plays in the country, and in terms of the role it plays in the region, it's a very, very important institution. And Israel has rivals in the region, in Iran, Hezbollah in Lebanon. And so the army is, it's on 24/7 alert to deal with those issues, security issues. And if there is a huge level of internal dissension inside the country, it does really pose a security threat. However, interestingly enough, you might expect that Iran or Hezbollah might sort of try to take advantage of this in some way or other, but they're not. They're being very quiet, and I think what they're trying to do is to figure out what is going on in Israel and basically let the dissension and let the conflict and the tension sort of work its way through Israel, because if it weakens Israel in terms of the way they look at things, that's a good thing. And they don't want to, for example, launch an attack on Israel or some target that will cause all of the Israeli citizens to circle back and sort of support the government because there's some kind of security crisis. They basically want to give Netanyahu no excuse or no way out of this crisis. And if that's what they're thinking, I think that's probably a wise approach.
And this fascist government also, in addition to, we're talking about the judicial system that they are trying to modify, they have passed some laws, including a law legalizing 5 Israeli colonies, settlements, that Israel had promised the United States before, I think under George Bush, that it would not be populated. And it also, and I think that really made the United States supposedly angry, and they even summoned the Israeli ambassador. And that is extremely rare for the United States to summon the Israeli ambassador. And the fascist government also passed a law removing the attorney, we talked about that, the attorney general's right to disqualify a prime minister convicted of a criminal offense. But this 5 settlement, legalizing 5 settlements, that, again, to you and me, like you mentioned before, Israel, we talk about settlements shortly and how they continue on daily basis to expand Israeli colonies on Palestinian land and so on and so on. But those specific colonies that it had promised the United States not to do them before, passed a law to legalize them.
The reason that happened is that the far right wing, which is playing this key role in this new government, has demanded it. Since 2005 was when Ariel Sharon and Bush signed this agreement saying that 5 settlements would never be settled, as you mentioned. And every Israeli government since then has honored it. In fact, I've never even heard about this until the past week when they passed this law. That was how understood it was on both sides, that this was a no-brainer, that Israel had accepted it and was honoring it, and the United States was honoring it. So what this is a slap in the face of the United States. It's a direct slap in the face of the United States. And that's the reason why they summoned Ambassador Herzog to the State Department. And as you said, not only unprecedented, I don't think it's ever happened that an Israeli ambassador has been summoned to the State Department for a dressing down. over something like this. So, it's just astonishing, breathtaking, the level of chutzpah, if you will, that Israel has exhibited here.
Now, of course, we are talking about all of this within the Israeli government and apartheid Israel's, what it's doing there. We cannot forget what Israel is doing to the Palestinians, that where Israel occupies their land. We have seen it over the years. As a matter of fact, we're getting close to the 75th anniversary of the Palestinian Nakba, mm-hmm. where Israel founded itself in 1948 after it wiped out more than 500 Palestinian villages, killed thousands of Palestinians, and forced many, many, many Palestinians out of their lands. What it's doing to the Palestinians on a daily basis, war crimes, genocide, ethnic cleansing, home demolitions, extrajudicial executions, you name it, even killing U.S. citizens like Rachel Corey 20 years ago or 1 year ago, U.S. citizen Shireen Abu Akla. I mean, these atrocities are happening day in and day out. So none of what we are seeing in the Israeli government, whether it's far right, far left, in the middle, Labor, Likud, you name it, that means nothing to the Palestinians, because no matter who is in charge of apartheid Israel, it is ethnic cleansing every single day in occupied Palestine.
If you look at the composition of the hundreds of thousands of Israelis that are protesting, you're not going to find any Israeli Palestinians, because it's not in their interest. There's nothing that these protests are trying to do, or the agenda of the what I call the pro-democracy movement. There's nothing that will help the Israeli Palestinians. I'm not talking about the Palestinians in the occupied territories. That's even worse, their predicament. But this is the Israeli Palestinians. The Israeli Jews in this pro-democracy movement aren't doing anything to draw the Palestinians into this movement, and the Palestinians really feel that they have no part in it. That's one aspect of this.
They're about 20%, right?
Over.
But 20% of the Israeli population are Palestinians, right? Who carry Israeli citizenship?
Nearly two million Israeli citizens are Palestinian, out of 9 million. So it's over 20% of the population are Palestinian. But the Israeli Palestinians are an afterthought in the minds of the Israeli Jewish majority. As you know, I'm sure well, the level of discrimination against Israeli Palestinians is enormous. The opportunities that they have, the healthcare, educational system, jobs, you name it, housing, and the level of crime in Palestinian communities, because the police don't police these communities, it's atrocious. But let's talk now about the conditions in the West Bank, which is even worse. Israel, since January, since the turn of the year, has killed nearly 200 Palestinians. Now, if you make that proportionate to an entire year, it means nearly 700 Palestinians will die in 2023. It's been the most dangerous, the most lethal time since the Second Intifada, which is 23 years ago. So Israel, it lives in this parallel universe where Israel itself and the Jewish majority is on one side, in one universe, and Palestine and the West Bank and the occupied territories are in a totally different universe. And the Israeli Jews on that one side never interact with the other side, unless they're in the army. And then they're serving amidst the Palestinians and committing the crimes that you and I have been talking about. So it's a terrible, terrible situation for the Palestinians in the West Bank. And Huwara, which you mentioned in regard to Smotrich, is a paradigm of what we're talking about, because one resident of Huwara in retaliation for Israeli attacks that killed Palestinians, this person from Huwara, killed two Israelis. And the result of that was that hundreds of Jewish settlers swarmed Huwara the next evening and practically burnt the whole village down. They burnt houses with people with babies in them. They burnt hundreds of vehicles, and they rampaged. It was you know, what they call a pogrom in this town. The police stood by and did nothing. The army stood by and did nothing. So that's what life is like for the Palestinians. So the biggest criticism, or one of the biggest criticisms of this democracy movement, is that it doesn't really talk at all about Palestinians. The most extreme in terms of left wing that they are is that some of the demonstrators will talk about the occupation and say, end the occupation. But that doesn't deal with the fact that even if you end the occupation, you're not ending apartheid. You're not giving full democratic rights to all Palestinians between the river and the sea. So it's a very limited protest movement, I would say.
You're listening to Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Our guest in this episode of Arab Voices is Richard Silverstein, a freelance journalist who writes the Tikkun Olam blog. We are discussing apartheid Israel's political system and the unprecedented protests against the new Israeli government. Richard, in terms of the interactions, you mentioned there is not much interaction except the Israeli colonizers in the Israeli settlements, where there are nearly 750,000 of them, live on Palestinian land, stolen Palestinian land, in the 22% of historic Palestine, what's left. And I'm talking about the occupied West Bank and occupied Jerusalem. Those colonizer settlers are really thugs. I mean, you mentioned what they did in Huwara, but their daily atrocities against the Palestinians throughout the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem is horrific. They constantly damage Palestinian properties. They uproot their olive trees. They burn homes. They burn cars. They attack them. I mean, it is a daily occurrence under the protection of the Israeli occupation forces and escorted in most of the time by the Israeli occupation forces. They are even armed themselves, those Israeli colonizers, and they are wreaking havoc in Palestinian villages and towns throughout the West Bank and Jerusalem. I know you wrote an article one time about them, and you just called them pure terrorists.
Yeah, well, let's talk about Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. Smotrich, as you mentioned, is the finance minister, but he's also, many people jokingly call him the governor of the West Bank. Because he's finance minister, he's going to funnel billions of dollars to the settlements. And he lives in a settlement. He is a settler. He wants not only to annex the West Bank, but if he could get away with it, he wants to eliminate Palestinian presence completely. And he wants to, in fact, in the Knesset about a year or two ago, he said, it's a shame that Ben-Gurion didn't finish the job in 1948, by which he meant that instead of there being just a Nakba in which a million Palestinians were expelled, he wanted there were 250,000 Palestinians who remained after the Nakba, and that's what has turned into the 2 million that exist now. He wishes that the remaining 250,000 in 1948 also would have been expelled, so that there would be no Palestinians in Israel and only Jews. So this is Smotrich. Now let's talk about Itamar Ben-Gvir. He's the national police minister. This guy has been convicted 50 times in an Israeli court of inciting terrorism. He's an accessory to terrorism. He's cultivated a cult in which he has teenage disciples, and he sends them on missions into Palestinian villages to burn cars and to throw petrol bombs into Palestinian homes, in which one case in Douma, they burned to death a young couple and their little baby, and their four-year-old child was left an orphan. This is the type of person that Ben-Gvir is. So you have two senior ministers in the Israeli government who are convicted terrorists. And let's go back to Smotrich for 1 second. He in 2005 was found by the Shin Bet to have 700 liters of gasoline in his car that he was planning to use to plant a bomb on the major highway in Tel Aviv as a protest against the Gaza withdrawal. These are the people that run the state of Israel.
This is astonishing. It's unbelievable that we support such war criminals, such a country that is wreaking havoc, and it's like the mother of all terrorism in the world right now, what Israel is doing. And it's really ongoing again, but like you emphasize, it is a whole lot worse now than ever before. Now, also, I wanted to mention something. I want to get your feedback on it. Those hundreds of thousands of demonstrators that are demonstrating against the judicial reform and the new Israeli fascist government, they don't go to the streets to protest Israeli war crimes on the Palestinians, Israeli wars on them, the ethnic cleansing, the all that stuff we're talking about. Why is that? We see some organizations, of course, like B'Tselem and others in over there that speak about Israeli atrocities, but not much when it comes to, or I guess because they are benefiting. They are, most of them are colonizers. They are benefiting from the money they get from Israel and the United States, living there on land that, after all, was stolen from the Palestinians. But if they are talking about democracy and so on, is it democracy only for Jews, period?
Absolutely. Israel is a democracy only for Jews. It's certainly not a democracy for Israeli Palestinians, and it's even I don't know what you would call a situation for the Palestinians in the occupied territories. It's the opposite of democracy. But the protesters, I want to say one positive thing about the protests. That is that there is a small element among the protesters, mostly young people, who come to the protests with Palestinian flags and wave the Palestinian flags and talk about apartheid in their banners. They acknowledge it and they denounce it. They are often attacked by other protesters because they're angry at the Palestinian issue being brought into their issue. And sometimes they're attacked by right-wing thugs who support the government. So they're really beset sometimes on all sides by the people in their own camp and by the enemy. But they're very brave about doing what they're doing. And I've seen many pictures of those Palestinian flags flying. Now, I have to say they're a minority. They represent, the good Israelis, if we can say that. There was one incident that I thought was very disturbing, and that was that in Haifa, earlier in the protest movement, in the first couple of weeks, they invited the leader of Hadash, who was an Israeli-Palestinian, and that's one of the left-wing Israeli-Jewish coexistence parties, and they invited her to speak. And they asked her to see the text that she was going to deliver. And she was going to talk about why Israeli Palestinians aren't at the protest. And they rejected her. And they said, no, you can't deliver that speech. And you're not welcome to speak. So this is the kind of problem that the Israeli society faces, that Israeli Jews want to live in a walled-off society where they do not have to hear or see Palestinians, except, when, of course, they have no choice if there's a terrorist attack. It sort of invades their reality, but otherwise they don't want to have anything to do with it.
And we've seen media coverage of how Israeli forces are handling Israeli demonstrators versus how the Israeli forces are handling Palestinian demonstrators that have been demonstrating. Whether in the occupied Palestinian territories, I'm talking about the West Bank, East Jerusalem, or even Palestinians who carry Israeli citizenship, those 20% plus who live in Haifa and Yaffa and other cities, when they demonstrate against Israeli atrocities peacefully for many, many years, they are completely ignored by the media, especially in the United States. They are not being covered. But when demonstrations like what we're seeing now, and yes, they are huge, they are covered a lot by the media, but if a Palestinian throws a rock at an Israeli soldier in the occupied territories and that soldier is injured, Palestinian terrorism is highlighted. But when Israelis shoot and kill Palestinians on a daily basis, demolish their homes, it's complete silence, as if it's okay by the U.S. media.
Yeah. Well, if a 14-year-old Palestinian throws a rock at an Israeli, he'll die. They will have no compunction. They don't arrest you if you throw a rock. They kill you. A sniper will put a bullet through your head. And that's happened. The reason why I mentioned a 14-year-old is it's happened several times. So, but the one thing I want to go back to the Israeli protests, what's unique and interesting about that is that the level of violence that the police are using against the Jewish protesters is unprecedented. It's certainly nothing like the violence that's used against Palestinians, but the use of horses to charge against unarmed Jewish protesters has been astonishing. I saw this video, which was very moving. A policeman on a mounted horse, you know, imagine these like 800-pound horses and 8 feet tall, charged a protester and blocked and pushed him into a wall, and the policeman had like an 8 foot long pole that he started beating the protester. So another Jewish protester took an umbrella and charged at the horse and the policeman, and the policeman was forced to retreat. So that's the level of drama that we're facing. But the idea that this policeman was beating a Jewish protester, nobody in Israel has ever seen such a thing happen to Jews from the police. So that's just another level of unprecedented violence that the police are using against Jewish citizens.
Richard, I want to talk about the United States and where Washington stands now towards what's happening in Israel, its best ally, quote unquote, both ways. Israel considers the U.S. best ally. Well, without the U.S., I don't know if Israel will survive. I mean, after all, taxpayers from the United States that need that money more than ever in the United States, they have been financing Israeli atrocities and Israeli war crimes and Israeli genocide and Israeli ethnic cleansing in Palestine for many, 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 many years. Every single year, the United States government gives Israel billions of U.S. tax dollars. They claim that Israel shares our values. What values are being shared with the United States other than creating wars and wreaking havoc around the world both ways? Anyway, but where does Washington stand now? We know Biden made some remarks unhappy with, I'm talking about the judicial reform that Netanyahu's coalition wanted to do. And there was even some reports that I know Biden said it lightly, basically, but there's supposedly a secret message that was sent to Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu on Monday by Biden, asking him to put an end to the judicial reform plans and try to find a middle ground. A straightforward, secret, supposedly message, no longer secret, to Netanyahu. And then after that, Netanyahu declared or announced that he is pausing moving forward for the time being with the judicial reform. What could you share with us about your knowledge of Washington's stance?
Well, the New York Times reported a few days ago that Biden, the entire Biden administration, that's the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, the U.S. Ambassador, Tom Nides, and Biden, all three of them were engaged in a full court press for a week, attempting to pressure and lobby and hector Netanyahu into pausing the judicial reforms. And he was adamant and opposed to it. And basically, there was nothing really he could do beyond that. It was the internal developments that with Gallant's statement and other things internally that happened that really were decisive. Although I think that the U.S. role here, it was important. I don't think that it was decisive because Netanyahu basically feels like he can ignore anybody, any outside element, or even the U.S. government. I mean, one time Netanyahu said about 10 or 15 years ago to a couple, to a family in the West Bank, I can wrap America around my middle, I can wrap it around my little finger. And so that's the sort of level of how much he really despises the U.S. government and the United States. But let's talk a little bit about some of the other things going on with the U.S. role. Today, the Progressive Caucus, the Democratic Caucus in Congress, and Senator Bernie Sanders released a letter that was one of the most astonishing statements that I've seen come out of the Congress about the Middle East, about Israel and Palestine. It was a very comprehensive letter. It not only denounced the judicial reform process, it denounced Netanyahu and the role that he's playing. It denounced his government. It also called for the first time in a sort of comprehensive way. In the past, we've had Democratic candidates talk about restricting U.S. military aid and making it dependent on Israel adhering to international human rights. This letter explicitly called for the Biden administration to not only do that, but to set up a process by which Israel would be judged so that the aid could be restricted accordingly. It also talked about military appropriations. It talked about the Leahy Act, which says that the U.S. government will not send aid to any government that violates human rights. This letter was signed by, I believe, maybe 10 members of Congress and by Bernie Sanders and a whole list, long list of American Jewish groups endorsed the letter as well. So nothing like this has really ever happened before. And I think it's important to point out a poll that came out right in the middle of Biden pressuring Netanyahu about this, the judicial reform. The Gallup poll said for the first time, more Democrats are sympathetic with Palestine than Israel. This is the first time ever in the history of the poll that anything like that has happened. So Biden is reading the tea leaves. He understands that even though Biden is a loyal Israel lobby ally and has been for decades, and also considers himself a close friend of Bibi Netanyahu and boasts about their long relationship, even Biden is a shrewd enough politician to understand the ground underneath the Democratic Party is changing, especially among the youth. There is no longer any level of sympathy for Israel at all. They've seen too much about what Israel is and what it's done, and they want no part of it. And even though Biden is sort of on the elderly sort of a generation in the Democratic Party, he's smart enough to understand. That's one of the reasons why he's been so adamant and so vocal about what's going on in Israel. He probably doesn't really want to do and say the things that he is, but I think he feels pressure, and rightfully so, from the progressive wing of his party.
Yeah, I think that is very critical and very important what you just mentioned about the 10 members of Congress, including Sanders, signing on that letter asking Biden to take action, basically, and how funds are sent or not sent to Israel. And also another thing that is very critical and important, which is Israel for decades has been using arms supplied by the United States to kill Palestinian civilians, to wage wars, and that violates the United States Arms Export and Controls Act. It basically violates that. That basically tells those countries that get money for weapons or weapons from the United States, you can only use them for legitimate self-defense. Israel has not been using them for that and has been using them completely in defiance of the United States Arms Export and Controls Act. So the U.S. should have stopped sending arms and weaponizing Israel decades ago. I want to ask you about the Jewish communities. I know there are various Jewish communities in the United States, throughout the world. There are a lot of organizations in the United States, some over the years, that have been very, very critical of Israeli occupation and Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians, like Jewish Voice for Peace and several others, and other organizations like AIPAC that are, I mean, they basically speak for Israel and defend Israel and fund Israel and all that stuff. Where do these stand about the recent changes in what's happening with Israel?
Well, American Jewish leadership, the mainstream of the community, has always been very quiescent when it comes to Israel, very leery about criticizing Israel, has always seen itself as sort of a loyal, you know, I would call it a lapdog. You know, they were talking about Tony Blair being Bush's poodle, and that's kind of what American Jews are to Israel. They're Israel's poodle. But as you said, there are a number of important Jewish groups like Jewish Voice for Peace and another younger group called If Not Now, which no longer are singing from the same hymn book. They are rejecting the fealty, the ironclad support that the community has historically offered to Israel. And I think that the more Palestinians that are murdered by Israel, the more violence there is on the West Bank and Gaza, the more ministers like Smotrich talk about wiping out and committing genocide, the more disgusted many American Jews are, and Democrats, and that's why that Gallup poll reflects that. So the Jewish community, I think the opinions are changing. I think the older generation still harbors that sort of sense of loyalty, and it will never really change. But the baby boomer generation and the younger generations than that are going to really see a major difference. And I might add that Bibi Netanyahu understands that. That's one of the reasons why he not only aligns himself with the Republicans, but he aligns himself with the Christian evangelical movement, because he realizes he's losing the Jewish community, which is 80 or 90% Democratic. So he has turned his back on the Democratic Party. He's turned his back on the American Jewish community because he believes that they're liberal and they're not going to stand with him. So that's really another way in which there's been a divorce between American Jews and Israel.
Interesting. And I think some of those organizations have supported or endorsed that letter you mentioned earlier, where 10 members of Congress have signed on.
Yes. One example is a liberal group called the Americans for Peace Now. It's not an especially radical group. It's what I call a liberal Zionist group. And it was probably one of the earliest of the peace movements, you know, going back to the 1970s or 80s. But a pretty moderate group, and they endorsed it, and they're promoting it. And there were 70 groups altogether that have made statements opposing the judicial reform, and a number of them have specifically endorsed this particular letter. So those are really indicating a sort of a sea change, I think, among American Jews about Israel.
Richard, what can you, as a citizen, do here in the United States to make a difference in what's happening there, to end this full impunity and complete blind, full support to the state of Israel, no matter what it does, no matter who's in power? What can people do to make a difference, to make a change?
Oh, boy, that's a hard one. because the political forces are much more powerful than any one of us individuals. But what I would say is that people should look for candidates running in Democratic primaries who are willing to criticize Israel, who are willing to talk about limiting military aid, and support those candidates. Go out and do the knocking on doors for candidates like that. Donate money to counter the AIPAC and the Israel lobby, which is attacking these types of candidates, and lobby your members of your senators, lobby your Congress members when legislation comes up. And when letters like the one we're talking about are written, tell your representative in Congress that you support this letter and that you want them to sign on as well. And very few, relatively, you know, to the 435 members of Congress, very few signed this letter. So there is plenty of room for other members of Congress to be lobbied to go along with this. I'm trying to think of other things that people could do. There aren't many rallies like what's happening in Israel, unfortunately, here. Actually, though, I should say that in a number of American cities, there have been protests against what the Israeli government is doing in terms of the judicial reform. So if you're in a city like a major city like Los Angeles or New York or Seattle or Boston, et cetera, there are protests that are happening. Just as an example, Bezalel Smotrich spoke in Washington, D.C. 2 weeks ago. And the U.S. government, by the way, gave him a visa to enter the United States, which I thought was an outrage. And many American Jewish groups protested against what the State Department did. So he spoke there, and there were two rallies against what he did in Washington, D.C. So people should sort of watch for things like events like that happening. And when they see that a speaker is coming from Israel or Palestine, is going to speak at their church or somewhere like that, they should go and they should support this peace movement and do things like that.
Richard, I know you write a lot of articles. You publish regularly, and I follow them and I read them, and they are a great resource for people to know. I loved your article just a few days ago that is titled "Israeli Settlers Are Not Jews, But They Are Terrorists." You said in that, I quote, "They are murderers, racist, genocidal thieves." I mean, that's exactly what it is. But I'm mentioning that because I would like you to mention your website to our listeners so they can educate themselves more and get to know the facts and truth about what's happening in occupied Palestine and with this new fascist right-wing Israeli government. Share with us that resource, please.
Thank you, Said. The name of my blog is Tikkun Olam, as you said, and the URL for my blog is richardsilverstein.com, and I publish a blog post there almost every day or every other day. And thank you for giving me a little plug there.
Absolutely, and I will have a link to that on our website, arabvoices.net. The only time I have left is to thank our guest, Richard Silverstein, who is a freelance journalist who writes the Tikkun Olam blog. Thank you, Richard, so much. We greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's been great to be with you, Saeed.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.